Well, hello everybody. My name's Danielle McLeod, and you've joined us for Conversations with Remarkable Women, which is run by Remarkable Women. And our organization is all about helping women make the difference in life they really long to make, whilst not having to compromise health, family, relationships, all of those things that hold us back from doing the things we most want to do. And you'll know by now, sometimes we meet with women who are in our community, and sometimes we bring in friends from outside our community who we've met along the way, who are doing pretty remarkable things in the world and who we want to be in conversation with so that we can learn from them. And I can tell you now, the lady we have with us today is totally remarkable. And also, I've been dying to have this conversation with her for ages. So I'm so chuffed that we get to do it and share it with everybody else. And I know she's already said to me, I'm hoping I can remember everything on the spot, but this is a woman who knows a lot of stuff. So I know that even under pressure, she's going to come up with some great things. So let me introduce you to Dr. Mary McLeod, who is a behavioral scientist. That's right, Mary.
Yep. Evolutionary biologist, to be specific.
Okay. And tons of us won't even know what that means. And you work specifically with understanding behavior, women's behavior, right? So could you explain to us a little bit about what a behavioral scientist does?
Well, in my way, I've studied animal behavior a lot. You know, I've been all over the world studying monkeys and whales and all sorts of stuff, which has been really amazing. But now I'm applying what I call an evolutionary approach to understanding human behavior. I've worked also as a freelance journalist for a number of years, where I get to interview lots of scientists about their work. So I've kind of built up this huge knowledge base of, you know, human behavior, why we do what we do, why have we evolved this behavior, what is it about the way we behave that helps us kind of reproduce and pass our genes on to future generations. And basically that's, you know, where a lot of our behaviors come from. You know, all our psychological traits have a big influence from genetics, but obviously, you know, other things come into play as well. So, you know, my whole thing is using an understanding of where our behavior is coming from, you know, why we do what we do, to then sort of design ways of helping people get to do things in a better way, you know, and achieve the things that they want to achieve, and help organizations structure things in a better way so that, you know, we can all fulfill our potential. And you know,
it's a different take than psychology, right? Because you're looking at biology.
Yeah, well, psychology, there's a sort of overlap. So if we look at evolutionary psychology, that's coming from the same kind of direction as me. I'm a biologist by background, but I know a lot about evolutionary psychology as well. So what evolutionary psychology is, you know, thinking in terms of how the psychology has evolved, you know, why is it beneficial to have these particular traits? But one of the things we find actually is that it's not always beneficial to have these evolved behaviours. And that's because a lot of the sort of psychological propensities or motivations have evolved back in the day when we were, you know, Stone Age people. We had a very different environment, maybe lived in very small groups, didn't have the huge structures that we have nowadays. And so that means that a lot of our evolved motivations, although we still have them, they don't always serve as well nowadays. I mean, a good example of that is we love to eat sugar and fat, don't we? A lot. The reason why we do that is because we've evolved this motivation to eat this stuff, because, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago, you know, on the savannah, in the caves, all the rest of it, we didn't have access to much of that kind of food, so we had to, you know, seek it out to keep our energy levels up. Nowadays, obviously, we have loads of access to this kind of food, and we can easily overindulge, and a lot of us do. But the thing is, though, the other thing that we humans have evolved is a great big brain under here, and we can consciously decide, you know, if we know that we have these bad tendencies, we can change what we do. It's not always easy because we've got the evolved motivations. So we really want that cream cake, you know, but we can decide not to eat it if we are armed with the knowledge of what's healthy. And so my premise is it's exactly the same with behavior and relationships and things. If we know the things we should try and avoid, we can take steps to try and avoid those things.
It's super helpful to understand that. Even though we might think we've evolved loads,
yeah,
much of the brain is still responding to patterns from thousands of years ago, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
And I think we forget that sometimes. It's like, well, we live in this really advanced technology world now, and there is still part of our brain is still behaving like a caveman, right?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that goes across all realms of life, you know, who we're attracted to, who we fancy. And, you know, I mean, I know, like many, many women throughout most of my life, I've been attracted to bad boys, you know, and there's kind of good evolutionary reasons for doing that, but doesn't necessarily, you know, help you towards a good long-term relationship. I've come to understand, you know, my motivations, why I do what I do and what I should be looking for, and how to kind of help myself make that happen. And I've managed to apply it to my own life. And I met this wonderful guy 3 years ago and kind of, you know, worked on myself to help make it work. And I'm getting married in September to this great guy. And it's, so as far as I'm concerned, that's a successful application of the
And did you, knowing what you knew, did you find that you had to watch out for certain tendencies in your own behavior?
I had to sort of really think about, you know, not getting, sort of looking for the right things and not being worried that, you know, I wasn't getting a certain aspects from the relationship, because I realized that those were destructive aspects. And so without going into too much detail, because I don't know who might watch this.
Well, tell us this, what's the cave woman looking for in a man versus what we think we're looking for?
Yeah, well, it's kind of, it depends on whether, I suppose a cave woman might be a lot more short term in her attitudes towards, you know, a partnership, because she might be interested mostly in good genetic material for her offspring, or a man that's, you know, high status with resources right there. But if we think about what we need for a long-term relationship, particularly nowadays when we're living a long time, we want a guy who is going to be supporting us, you know, emotionally as well as in other ways, helping look after the kids. And these things aren't necessarily going to be compatible with personality that's highly competitive and status seeking. But nowadays, you know, a large number of women still are attracted to men who are highly competitive and status seeking, because, you know, they seem really sexy and everything. But if we get together with them, we might find that it doesn't work out in the long run, because those personalities aren't necessarily built for a good long-term relationship. So
you're saying the things that we find sexy are sometimes going right back to our evolutionary.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. But if we know what to look out for, I mean, sometimes that's fine. You know, if you think that this is going to be a short-term thing, go for it, you know, make the most of it. But if you are looking for something more long-term, then, you know, you might be needing to sort of think about different things. So it's worth being armed with the knowledge. And, you know, that's what I aim to help people with, basically.
And tell me about that. So are we, I get that we're naturally wired to think in a certain way. I would imagine most of us know it's better to have a guy who is going to look after us in a more holistic way, or be in a combined partnership with us, who's going to be willing to share the load, who isn't going to go out and set off war with anybody who's got a bigger chest than him or the rest of it. What is it you're teaching people to watch out for? I mean, are you really saying the brain is going to really flash these signs at you and you're going to have to think differently?
Yeah, well, I suppose it's in the very first instance, when you first meet somebody, you might feel hugely attracted to someone that might not be a suitable long-term partner. Yeah. So I think the message is that you have to be aware of what you're looking for in the long term. Yeah. And then what you can find is, if you pick someone based on their kind of long-term potential, if you like, you can find ways to then, you know, become highly attracted to this person. You know, research suggests that if we really like someone's personality, we start finding them more physically attractive, for example. So basically, it's about not giving up right at the start. It's about kind of persevering if you know that this is a good, you know, a good guy for you to go for.
So you're almost saying it's a very instant reaction is the kind of more primal reaction.
Then
to really notice, because that's the same with sugar, right? It's like, I want the sugar.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then there's a kind of more evolved brain that will go, well, hang on a minute, consequences, do you really want it, blah blah blah. So you're almost saying Are you saying there are instances where I really don't trust the initial reaction or explore it more?
Well, I think just think it through a bit more. You know, decide what it is you really want and, you know, if this is going to do it for you, basically. Yeah.
I love this because a lot of the work we do with our women is like really understanding the mind more and understanding the patterns it creates so that you make conscious choice rather than subconscious choices that you wouldn't have made if you had sat down and thought about it. And really you're saying the same thing from a, you know, as you're really wired to have all of these different reactions. Yeah. And it takes a bit of effort to one know that, well, it takes a bit of knowledge to know one, you are wired to react this way. And secondly, then you've got to choose to not go with your impulses all the time, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Great. So you do tons and tons of work with women. I know that you do. And one of the things I've always wanted to talk to you about, because you dropped it into a conversation once and I never got to hear more. I know it's on your speaker topic list, which, guys, is amazing. Man, can talk about so many things. You said to me once about something about how women are not wired to help each other. It might not have been exactly that, but it was this kind of thing about how women can be a bit bitchy with each other.
Yeah, it's definitely like, not that.
I want to know about that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, women do help each other a lot. And you know, that's absolutely a feature of women generally is that they are nice. You know, we are empathetic. But we do compete with one another, just in the same way that men compete with each other. But we do it in a very different way. We have to compete because, you know, we need the same things. Mm. So we compete over resources, we compete over mates, you know, just the fact of, you know, dressing up in a sexy way, that's essentially competing with other women. Mm-hmm. You know, because
peacocking.
So women compete in a different way from men. We tend to do it covertly, so we don't want to be seen to be competing because that would be too risky. Men, they go for it, you know, hammer and tongs, sometimes literally, and they, you know, they kill each other even, and, you know, women tend not to kill each other. If we actually physically fight, it generally means we've lost control completely. So the way women compete is, it tends to be, you know, things like talking behind each other's backs, social exclusion. We're often not aware we're even doing it because we kind of tend to think of ourselves as really nice. Mm. And a lot of the time we are. But, you know, this has pros and cons for us. Because we compete in that way, we've evolved to be very, very sensitive to each other's feelings and motivations. We need to know who's for us and who's against us, basically. Mm. So that means that women tend to be sort of higher in the personality factor agreeableness than men. And what that means is that we are more empathetic. We understand each other's feelings more. We're more inclined to take each other's feelings into account. And we also can see if someone is maybe not on our side. You know, we're far, far more sensitive than men are to kind of nuances and communication. I mean, even the way we text each other or something, you know, whether we do we put a kiss or do we put a smiley, you know, is really vitally important. Or it is to us anyway. But you know, that can have its pros and cons. I mean, the obvious pros are that, you know, we can do really well in people-oriented jobs, you know, where we need to understand others. You know, we can read a room really well. I mean, these are all averages, of course. No, not all women are good at this and not all men are bad at it. You know, there's a spectrum and
that's a lot. But you're saying kind of biologically we're wide more.
But on average, you know, we have that tendency more. It's quite a robust gender difference. So we're good at...
Sorry, can I just come to that for 1 second? Yeah. Because I hear that it's a robust gender difference and certainly, you know, evidence would suggest that. But I think what you're saying is it's... Because some people would argue it's a gender difference because of the way we normalize culture and the way we speak to women anyway and what we expect from women. And are you suggesting that, yes, that and also biological wiring? Or...
Yeah, I think the two things are interconnected. Right. So I think... The biology makes us a little bit different, and then so society expects us to be a bit more empathetic, be a bit nicer. Mm. And so, you know, it's a kind of vicious or a virtuous circle, depending on how you look at it. There are numerous differences on average, biologically speaking, between men and women. Mm. you know, there are mountains of evidence from lots of different sources that that is the case. But that doesn't mean, obviously, that we're kind of stuck with those differences. We, like I said, we've got the brain to kind of overcome things if we wish to. And also, as I said, it's not kind of universal. It's not all women and not all men. There's big overlap. So there's no reason to kind of suggest that, you know, if you have a human that is one particular way, that they must be a woman or they must be a man. I mean, it's just like, if you think of height as an example, a physical example, we all know that men tend to be taller than women, but that doesn't mean to say that all men are taller than all women. You know, there's lots and lots of variation. And so you can't tell from someone's height whether they're male or female. But anyway, I mean, yes, so there's this difference in this personality factor that affects our sensitivity to others' emotions and feelings and, you know, ideas. And it's an advantage for women in some respects, but it also can mean that we're less competitive and we're less willing to speak out. You know, we all know that the women tend to be sort of less confident about speaking out. It's partly because of that agreeableness, and it's partly because it's because, again, ironically, because of the way we're relating to other women. Women tend not to like it when their peers are sort of getting above them or speaking out, you know, in a way that's sort of pushing them down. So women tend to be very, very sensitive to kind of showing off, if you like, in front of other women. You know, as we all know, men love to show off and take risks, and, you know, jump off things and do all sorts of stuff. But women don't do that. Women tend to be quite risk averse compared with men. And again, you know, this is a generalization, you know.
I'm pretty unforgiving of women who do show off, right?
Exactly. Yeah, we don't like it. We, you know, who does she think she is, kind of thing. And if we do well at something, if we, you know, if we kind of win a game of tennis or something, you know, oh, well, it's just a fluke. I've had it. That was a good day, you know. It wasn't because of any special talent or anything. Or if we do well on an exam, again, you know, oh, well, I don't know how that happened. I think the right questions came up, you know, that sort of thing. You know, we tend to really play down our achievements, whereas obviously men shout about theirs from the rooftops, and they have evolved to do that. You know, men are much more inclined to be status seeking because it brings them benefits. You know, it's always brought them, you know, through evolutionary time, the men that kind of behaved in such a way to gain dominance over other men and took risks to do that, they basically got more sex. They got to have sex.
Oh, now here's the heart of the matter.
and so the you know, the propensity for that kind of behavior has been passed down genetically through
it all boils down to sex. That's what you're saying. Love it.
It boils down to reproduction.
Okay. Which, and the survival of your gene.
Yeah, so it's about, you know, your genetic lineage. You know, the men who didn't take risks, didn't gain dominance, didn't do things that would make women fancy them or, you know, have dominance over other men, their genetic lineage has died out, obviously, because they wouldn't, you know, they didn't get sex. And so it kind of makes sense that men behave that like that. You know, they have much bigger egos than women, for good reason, because, you know, if they're competing with other men,
you can measure ego.
I'm not sure if you can.
I'm going to ask that from a scientist.
There must be a way. I'll think about that one.
Okay.
But in the competition with other men, you know, men have to exude confidence. They have to at least pretend that, you know, they're good at things, they're cleverer than the other guy, they're bigger, fiercer, whatever it is. And the best way to, you know, pretend something is to believe it yourself, and hence the big egos, you know. Women, on the other hand, they haven't really had to evolve big egos because we're not competing in that same way. So, you know, perhaps it's not that women are less confident, maybe it's that we're more realistic. But in
maybe we want less sex.
Well, I'm not sure about that.
But that's the thing, right? I mean, just listening to you, I think this is fascinating. Because what we're hearing is men want to continue their genetic lineage.
Yeah.
I guess I'm curious, do women want to continue theirs biologically?
Of course, yeah, women do too, because, you know, if women hadn't behaved in a way to do that, you know, their lineage would die out. And so it's only the women who behaved in such a way to continue their genetic lineage that are here today, Like,
actually, they're selecting.
Yeah.
The men they are choosing.
So, that's one way. That's one way. But also, rather than taking big risks and gaining dominance over other women, the priority for women over evolutionary time has been to survive and to have their children survive. Mm. Because if a woman dies in a battle with other women, their children would die, certainly in ancestral times. You know, their children are dependent on them for survival. So if they go off and take a big risk and don't come back, then that's the end of their genetic lineage, you know. So for women, it's about survival. And we know that we take much more care of our health than men do. We don't take the same risks as men do. So women are more risk averse, but that doesn't mean that we should stop ourselves doing, you know, great things at work, because I think it's worth being aware that we have this propensity for risk aversion, but then we can overcome it in different ways.
That's exactly what I was thinking, because if the natural core of the propensity comes from, I got to survive in order to look after my children, which I think most mothers would relate to. For most, I mean, certainly for people listening to this, that's not a real thing. You know, it's not actually, my kids aren't going to, I'm not going to die out on the battlefield, or I'm not going to die going out and getting food. And therefore, it's another overplayed brain response, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely true. Yeah. I mean, I think we need to learn to assess the risks and actually think about, well, is this really a big risk? You know, it's not like we're going out to fight lions in the savannah, you know. It's not like we're going to be
presenting at a conference.
yeah, it's just getting up in front of people and speaking, or, you know, maybe you'll lose some money, or maybe you'll not, you know, be successful as soon as you might if things go wrong, or you might have to wear Primark instead of, you know, Versace for a while, or, you know, whatever it is. It's not such a massive risk, is it? And so, you know, There are a number of ways, I think, that we can sort of overcome that feeling of risk. I think one of them is just sort of starting small and building up, you know, and showing ourselves that we can do it and feeling the buzz from achievement. I mean, to give you an example, I have always been absolutely terrified of public speaking. And, you know, like really, really terrified. When I used to get up in front of it, even a group of small group of people to speak, I'd feel as if I was having an out-of-body experience or something, you know. But, you know, I realised that if I wanted to get my message across, I was going to have to do it. So I just kind of bit the bullet. I started with very small groups to begin with, found that it was actually really great, you know, and I didn't die, or, you know, the earth didn't swallow me up, and then gradually sort of built it up. And so, you know, now I'm doing much bigger talks, and, you know, I still have to prepare big time. You know, I haven't got the kind of personality where I could just walk out in front of thousands of people and just wing it. You know, that's just not me. But I've managed to get to a stage where I can do it, and you know, and that feels great. It's a real sort of buzzy feeling, you know, when you actually do these things that get, you know, that have been way outside your comfort zone, and you manage to conquer that. So that's a brilliant thing.
And does it help you to be able to say, oh, it's my primal brain, I can put that to one side for a bit? Or
yeah, not? I suppose so. Yeah. And
so tell me, because I'm thinking, as you were talking about women competing in a less obvious way and social exclusion and this tendency to not show off. And in my head, I was like connecting dots and thinking, maybe that explains like gossip magazines, because women love to look at magazines. I don't read them anymore. I'm not a fan on any level, that kind of trash other women, right? But you don't see men doing that. There's no market really for men trashing other men in magazines, is there? And I'm guessing that comes from this slightly different response to competition, right?
Yeah, I think these magazines are absolutely preying on this kind of natural motivation to sort of, yeah, want to know about what other women are up to, and find some way, even if they're really successful, we manage to spot that bit of cellulite, so they're not that good, are they? So it kind of helps us boost ourselves in some way, which is not very nice, really. But no, I think there are a lot of ways that we can change things around that. We don't have to kind of give in to that competition. I mean, there will always be competition for certain things, but I think we're going to help women, all of us, you know, all of us together, if we can, you know, get over that in some sense, and, you know, form alliances and do things together a lot more. You're not going to get, you know, all women creating a massive sisterhood, that's just impossible, but we can form groups of women that can really, really support and help one another, and that's definitely going to push the agenda forward for women.
I think it's really exciting to know that our tendency is actually to behave in a way we don't especially like, you know, to exclude some women, or to be kind of, let's pull you down a little bit in order that I can preen my feathers, but none of us got to look too good because that creates a problem for us all, kind of thing. I think it's super helpful to know that, because then you know what you're working with, you know. And I think certainly when I worked with women in leadership campaigns, and my experience, I grew up in construction. And so one of the loveliest things that happened for me personally in construction was I was a woman in a field of men. And whilst it was all very, very difficult sometimes, and people would literally come in, and I was an associate partner, and they would say, "Danielle, the tea's not ready," kind of thing. And I was like, what was useful was, because I was one of, like, I think there were like four of us as women who really stood out in the company, you know, that's a big status thing, right? So when more women come to the fore, there's a chunk of you that wants to help, and there's this little niggly bit, and yeah, but you won't be so special then. You know, and that's kind of coming from what you're talking about. And certainly I see in this whole women in leadership conversation, there's a bit of an edge in there sometimes from some women around, well, I had to work really hard for this, why don't they have to? Or I managed to break through, if they're not strong enough, they can't do it. Whereas, you know, I'm much more interested in this whole stand on my shoulders thing. How do I help you in a way that doesn't harm me but gives you access to more? But really knowing that I'm not evolutionarily wired for that to be my natural response is quite helpful, because then you know what, there's a real thing in your mind that you can say, oh, I need to put that down now, right?
Yeah, well I mean, we can change things. We can change our own behaviour by changing the environment that we're in. So the situation you're describing is, you know, what leads to the sort of queen bee effect, as we know, you know, senior women not supporting junior women. And that kind of makes sense, because as you say, if the senior woman has really fought to get there, you know, well, why should I help you? You know, I had to really fight to get up here. And also if you you might threaten my position, because there's only room for a very small number of us up here. Mm. But obviously, if we can increase the number of spaces for women, then that totally changes the dynamic and makes women feel less threatened. Mm. I think there seem to be different kinds of female leader. There are the queen bees that don't support other women. And there are the women who are really, really supportive of junior women and help them. And I've been very curious to sort of try and work out what is the difference between those two. And I think, you know, from my own thinking about it and talking to various experts, I think it comes down to how threatened women feel and how supported they've been in the past by women. And I think it would really, really benefit organisations to support women who are supporting women, you know.
I love that. I've never thought about that.
Support them. And if women can sort of get together and support each other and support people who are vocally in pushing the agenda forward for women, then that's going to help all women, obviously the top women, but also the junior women coming up. Can I tell you about a primate example?
Because
I'm a primatologist, I'd love to explain how the world of primates can help illustrate this issue.
We have a woman in our community who's going to love this bit. This is like
so our closest relatives in the animal kingdom, right, there's two of them that are equally closely related. One is chimpanzees. Mm-hmm. Chimpanzees, I don't know if you've seen David Attenborough's Dynasties series, but in the chimpanzees it illustrates really well how despotic and nasty the males can be. You know, they really, really are in charge. They're totally dominant over the females. They're very aggressive. They kill each other sometimes. And there's no question that the females, you know, are kind of under the power of the males, if you like. Our other closest relative is the bonobos. The bonobos, they're quite similar looking to chimpanzees. They live in a different part of Africa. But bonobos behave very, very differently. The males are still bigger than the females, but the females are the ones that are in charge. They make the decisions. They get priority of access to food. And do you know why that is? It's because the females back each other up. They form alliances. And so, you know, I think we can learn from our bonobo sisters. But basically, it's because of the ecology. You know, the bonobo females are spending more time together just because of the distribution of their food. So they get to form alliances. I mean, one way they form alliances is through having sex together. So I'm not necessarily advocating that all women might want to do this. But there are other ways of cementing friendships. And women are so good at forming close friendships, much better than men are. Men's friendships tend to be much more casual. I mean, this is, again, a generalisation. But in general, women tend to have very, very close friendships. And there's a lot of evidence that having a very close sort of circle of female alliances in a work context as well as a personal context can really help give women success. There was a piece of research reported in the Harvard Business Review just recently, just pointing this out. You know, men and women both do really well if they have big networks, but women, and only women, do especially well if they have a small, you know, very close network of female alliances. And this is because, oh, I can't hear you anymore, Danielle.
Hang on. We call it the Wisdom Council.
Right, yeah.
This idea that you would bring a small body of trusted women around you to kind of be your advisory place and to check in with. And I think it's a game changer when there is a place where you can really show up authentically, right?
Yeah. So I think if we can change the environment to one where women can support each other, then, you know, we can kick this competition out the window kind of thing. Mm. I'm a member of a small mastermind group. It's just four of us, four women. And it's for, it was through the Professional Speakers Association. So it's all to do with our speaking business. And it's great. We meet up maybe once a month. We have, you know, we get together and have a coffee and a good chinwag. Mm. And we bring our issues about work to the fore and, you know, get advice from each other. We've all got different backgrounds and experiences, so we, you know, can get some really good advice. And we've all got each other's backs. We can recommend each other. You know, we can tell each other about, you know, events that are coming up that might be useful. You know, all sorts of stuff. Mm. It's really, really good. And I don't think it would work the same if it was a mixed group. You know, women do like to talk together with other women, and I think they feel a lot more sort of able to express themselves easily with a group of just women.
I love that you're saying that, because certainly we get challenged sometimes around, there are men who would love to join us in the work that we're doing. And of course, everything we do is relevant for men, but and equally my experience also and Nick's is that women open up more when it's a purely female circle, and so and also there's an ability to have a different kind of conversation. Because of the things we experience that men do not, and certainly, you know, menopause being a classic, or motherhood, or, you know, there's so much going on that you might edit. Mm-hmm. in a differently balanced community. And that's not, you know, we think men are amazing, but it's like sometimes we just need that space, right? I'm so excited about the bonobo thing. I literally wrote there like a blog heading saying be like a bonobo, right? So how do we, because I love that. I hope you write on that at some point.
Yes I will. In fact, you spurred me on to do it.
Because I just feel like it's what a glorious model that goes back so far of women demonstrating a different behavior. And it's funny you say that as well, because another lady who's going to come on Conversations with Remarkable Women, she works for the Global Fund, and she administers kind of $1 billion grants to countries in Africa. And one of the things she says to me, which is so interesting there, she said, you know, there are many women leading parts of Africa and leading tribes in Africa. And she says, so sometimes when they come to Western Europe, they are surprised at the way it is here. And it's almost like maybe different sections have taken, you know, one of those primates or the other and taken that model and gone with it.
Yeah, I think in Western society we have a much more hierarchical structure in all of our sort of organizations and things, and that tends to suit men a lot better. You know, women's kind of leadership, I mean, women have massive influence everywhere, but in a sort of formalized way, it just doesn't kind of get attention in our kind of society. I mean, going back to the bonobos, actually, you know, the influence of females is much more peaceful, if you like, than the influence of male chimpanzees, you end up having a much more peaceful society. Bonobos do not, you know, fight or have, you know, battles nearly as much, even between communities, as much as chimpanzees do. And it sort of underlines, you know, the kind of, if females are allowed to have more leadership and influence, which is much more about communication, empathizing with each other, understand, you know, having mutual understanding rather than, you know, telling people what to do from the top down. I think it's going to be good for everyone, not just women, but men as well, you know, and men will hopefully then have more of a chance to have a good work-life balance too, you know, take more, you know, time to take care of kids and things like that. And, you know, that's another massive subject.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I've just written something else down, which I really shouldn't be doing while we're recording, but you're just popping my brain constantly. Yeah. And one of the things that I often teach in corporates is this idea that, and I, that we need to stop being warriors, men and women, right? Because everything is not a war. And actually, people are a bit exhausted corporately with being at war with each other all of the time. And so let's learn some different behaviors. And I think what's so interesting about what you're saying there, which probably never come to me before, what you're really saying is, well, the men are wired to be at war. So they might not want to be anymore, but they are wired that way. And so some of that competition and that behavior of let me be top dog is not so healthy, right? Because I did watch some of that Attenborough series and I was quite astounded at the constant exhaustion the kind of chief of the tribe is in, because someone's always after his spot, aren't they?
Yeah.
Like always.
Well, the thing is though, you know, like I said, if you change the environment, it changes things for women and relationships among women. It's the same for men. You know, they don't have to be at war. If you know, nowadays in our part of the world, we're in a relatively peaceful phase for us anyway. We're also in a situation where women are going out to work. They're, you know, contributing massively to, you know, household income, sometimes being the main breadwinners. That is an ecological circumstance where it totally makes sense for men to take much more part in the domestic sphere. I'm actually collaborating to run maternity career support program with a lady called Vicky Zuderant. We've just been doing some pilots and it's been going really well. Mm. And my part of it is basically to sort of try and help women get through maternity leave with their emotional and sort of physical health intact, and mental health, you know, to get back into their career successfully. And what I'm doing is sort of arming them with the biological knowledge they need to get the support they need and show what, as human beings, we are evolved to do and what we need. One of the things is we're cooperative breeders. That means that we need others to help in looking after the kids. You know, that's the way we're made.
Yeah,
we're not supposed to be, you know, women at home with baby on her own. And, it, you know, it, as they say, it takes a village to raise a child kind of thing. And those other people that are helping, they could be grannies, they could be aunties, they could be fathers, but not necessarily. It depends on the circumstances. So if you live in a society like a sort of fiercely warring tribe, like the Yanomamo in the Amazon, you know, the guys don't take any care of the children. What they're doing is spending their time protecting the kids from being killed by, you know, warring tribes. You know,
a worthy job.
But in a situation where we're not at war, you know, women are bringing home the bacon as well, then, you know, there's absolutely no reason why men can't also take a big role in looking after the kids. And there's certainly no biological reason why men can't be just as involved parents right from the very beginning, apart from the breastfeeding, as women are. And, you know, the research suggests that the earlier a guy gets involved, you know, even during pregnancy, the more likely he is to sort of carry on that involvement as time goes on. So I sort of try and impress upon the mums in our program, you know, get your partner to take this on, that, you know, he can do this. And but obviously we as society have to support that as well. And as women, you know, we have to, if we want equality at work and in the home, we have to be prepared to relinquish that sort of special status of, you know, being the, you know, special parent, the main parent, if we want, you know, to have equal involvement from our partners. So, you know, it goes both ways, if you like. But I think, that's where things need to go. If women are going to have equal access to careers, you know, they need to have equality in the household as well, with childcare and domestic stuff and all the rest of it.
Yeah. Wow. We could be at this for a long time, couldn't we? And we don't, because we run this for like just under an hour usually. So I didn't put this question to you. So if you don't have an answer immediately, don't worry about it. But it just came to me then. What's clear talking to you is there's just this body of information behind you, which is really exciting, and just so many places we could play. You're out in the world talking about women's behavior from a biological perspective and what that means and how we can adjust it. Mm-hmm. What's the one thing, if you've got one, that you wish everybody knew? You know, like, what's the one message that you like, if I could get this out in the world, that would be so good?
Crikey. That's quite difficult. One thing. I mean, I suppose it would have to be a sort of general thing that, you know, there are differences, you know, biologically between men and women. But if we understand what these things are and how they're expressed, you know, we can make the world better for everybody and get you know, a better work-life balance. I'm trying to think. I'm going to think of, you know, the perfect...
Yeah, but I love that anyway, because I think we can't argue that we're not different. You know, clearly we are. Every human's different from another human, right?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Loads of commonality and loads of differences. And, you know, I'm always in a space of if we can honour the yin and the yang and bring it together. But also, I think what's so exciting about what you're saying is we might have all this biological wiring, but we are slowly unpicking it. And there's no reason biologically why we can't change it. And so I think it's so lovely to hear, you know, fundamentally, there are still parts of you that will respond like a cavewoman or a caveman. Mm-hmm. And the science shows that we can change it, right? Mm-hmm. And I think... that's a really glorious message. And
I think something else that's very important, though, is we should learn to capitalize on our female traits and not try to be more like men.
Oh, yes.
I mean, there are so many good things about being a woman. I think some of them causes problems in organizations that were designed for and by men. I mean, you know, it's fair enough that was the case because they did it, you know, but we're here now. And, you know, we can change things so that, you know, we can capitalize on our own talents and traits. Mm. We can give organizations the benefit of those talents and traits and create, you know, organizations that are good for everybody with a good work-life balance and, you know, being able to take care of parts of your life that are outside of work as well as, you know, what's going on in the workplace. I think that's really, really important.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen the evidence on empathy and agreeableness before, but it's really exciting to talk about it again, because I think that's not, whilst women might exhibit it more, my experience is wherever you go in big organizations, people want more of it. Yeah. And so actually bringing more women into senior roles is an easy way to even out that imbalance, right? And to have more of that. And I think that's good news for all of us. So let me ask you this, because I know you're Scotland-based like me, you're in Edinburgh. If our women want to find you, I'm thinking, is LinkedIn the best place? Your website? Where do they?
Yeah, connect with me on LinkedIn. That would be great. It's Dr. Mary McLeod. My website is marymcleod.com. That's MairiMacLeod. Or just email me at mary@marymcleod.com.
Brilliant.
And what else? Yeah, I've got a Facebook page, which is, again, Dr. Mary McLeod. I put sort of interesting articles up there. Join my mailing list, all of those things, and you can get lots more of this stuff.
Fabulous. And if you're in Scotland listening to this, Mary's often at speaking events, so you want to be on her mailing list so that you can find out what she's doing. We are not related, in case anyone wanted, or not that we're aware of. And also, I just wanted to say as a real quickie, I'm delighted that you're honouring the doctor in you, because obviously that's a topic of conversation as well, right? That often it doesn't feature for women in the same way that it does for men. So we have a real live doctor on the show with a ton of scientific experience behind her. And I just wanted to thank you for being willing to spend the time with us today.
Brilliant. And if anyone wants to get in touch for a one-to-one chat about any of this stuff, then very happy to do that.
Well, there's an offer you should not refuse if you're listening to this. What a brilliant, brilliant conversation. I can't wait to share it with everybody. And another remarkable woman in conversation with us, which is great. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Danielle. Lovely speaking to you.
You too.